What do you see? What does it mean, really? Consider, here's a true story. I don't think I've told it here before, but if I have, forgive me. Anyway, years ago, I took my son, Billy, at that time, to see his first baseball game at the Sky Dome. The Sky Dome was still new and amazing, and as now, Toronto had a fine team in those days. It was very exciting. I think Billy was 4 going on 5. Billy and I took our seats high up in the cheap blues, deep in foul territory, because that's what I could afford at the time. And reaching up, I could almost touch the track that the retractable dome runs on. When I looked down on the field, though, I could only barely see what appeared to be a baseball game. When I put my fingers out in front of me, the players looked about this big if I put my thumb and forefinger there. To actually see the key plays, I had to watch reruns on the 3-story tall Jumbotron, is what they called it in those days, that hung over Hard Rock Cafe in center field. Anyways, I was sitting there watching the Jumbotron, and it occurred to me suddenly that Billy, who, as I said, was almost 5, Billy did not have a clue as to what was going on down in the field. Now, mind you, Billy was fascinated by a bunch of guys sitting bare-chested beside us who were showing off big blue letters on their bare bellies and were drinking a lot of beer to a lot of shouting and mutual encouragement. And later, when Billy got tired of the rowdies, he sampled a hot dog, he sampled popcorn, he sampled ice cream. Ultimately, though, what intrigued Billy the most was the restroom. He had never seen anything like it in his short life. Nearly 100 white porcelain fixtures, as small, as far as his low to the eye, ground eyes could see. Billy went back to check out that amazing restroom, I think, 4 times, even though, ironically, he never managed to go once. And Billy never saw that Sky Dome main event. Even though he was at that baseball game for 9 full innings, he didn't see the game. It was too hard for him to follow, and there was too much interesting stuff going on all around him to focus on the main event. He didn't have a head yet for ERAs or RBIs, or come to think of it, he still doesn't. He wasn't yet schooled in squeeze plays or home runs, so Billy never saw the game. Now imagine that life was like that game. When you look around, what do you see? Or more to the point, when you watch the news on television or read the paper or magazines, or when you consider all those viral Nova stories that pop up on Facebook, what do you see, really? That is the question that Jesus is addressing in today's text. Your eye, says Jesus, is the lamp of your body. A better sense of the passage might be, since they didn't have glass in those days or prisms or that kind of thing, a better sense of the passage might be, your eye is the lens of the body, or your eye is the window into your body. And so if your eye is healthy, then your body will be full of light. But if it's not healthy, your body will be full of darkness. So again, how are your eyes? Do they let in real light? The light that's really there, I should say? Or do your eyes distort the light? What do you really see? Now, we can laugh at how Billy's eyes couldn't make any baseball sense of the Sky Dome, but not making proper sense of the world, I fear, is something that most of us as adults are quite prone to ourselves. Let's just take, for example, the word that the Oxford International Dictionary just proclaimed as the 2016 word of the year. That word is post-truth, as in we live in a post-truth society. That is, according to most political and cultural commentators, we live in an era where people will believe anything they see or read so long as they're told to believe it by someone they admire or it suits their preconceived prejudices, or if they find it on the internet, they'll believe it. What's more, and perhaps more dangerous, is that powerful people, industries, political groups often use this gullibility to get their own way. The word post-truth was first used, so I read this article about this Oxford choosing post-truth, and according to this article, the word was first used years ago to describe the advertising campaigns of the tobacco industry. Beginning in the mid-60s, the tobacco industry used obfuscation and misdirection to cast doubt on the growing scientific consensus that smoking tobacco kills people. The tobacco industry didn't want people to see cigarettes as dangerous, however. So they outlined this strategy. The strategy was outlined in what's now a very famous memo that was leaked. And the title of this memo is The Smoking and Health Proposal, and it was written by people at the Brown and Billison Tobacco Company. And for the entire tobacco industry, this memo detailed that industry's strategy for derailing the anti-smoking movement. For example, in a section of the memo describing advertising strategy, the memo said, "Doubt is the best means of competing with that body of fact that exists in the mind of the general public. It is also a great means for establishing controversy." What sort of doubt? Well, for example, when scientific studies show that smoking kills mice, the tobacco industry should respond by saying that such studies are totally beside the point, because can't anybody see that mice are not people and so it doesn't apply? Don't argue the evidence, just associate the evidence with doubt. And as a result of the tobacco industry doing just this, far too many smokers who are already facing this uphill and difficult and unpleasant task of quitting, far too many smokers simply decided to go with the tobacco industry's doubt rather than with good science. They chose to see things the way it was most comfortable for them to see things. But post-truth became Oxford's word of the year, especially, as we all know, in the context of the American presidential election this year. In the campaign, a landslide of falsehoods overwhelmed the electorate. For example, the Washington Post, which is normally a very Republican newspaper, The Washington Post awarded its maximum dishonesty rating, that was four Pinocchios, it awarded its maximum dishonesty rating to nearly 70% of Donald Trump's election claims and tweets. Among Trump's statements that the paper totally debunked, but which were widely believed among at least a portion of the electorate, were these claims. Barack Obama is not an American citizen. Barack Obama spent $4 million to hide the truth of his non-American birth. Hillary Clinton was the one who started the birther stories. Thousands of Muslims turned out into the streets the day after 9/11 to celebrate the attacks. Trump started his business with just a little loan from his father. The father of Senator Ted Cruz, one of his opponents in the primary, was a pal of John F. Kennedy's murderer, Lee Harvey Oswald. The Russians had nothing to do with the false news stories about Clinton circulating on the internet, false news stories such as she had a child pornography ring working out of a pizza joint in Washington, I believe it was. Widely circulated, widely believed. The Russians did not hack the DNC's email server. So how do you see these things, really? Especially since your eye, says Jesus, is the lens of your body, the lens of your soul. How should you see these things? This matters because what's at stake in our time is not just your own personal private set of lungs. What's at stake here in a case where the science is attacked in a way very comparable to the tobacco wars of a generation ago, a whole set of private and political interests are sowing a pinch of doubt wherever they can because they want us to believe that this planet is not, after all, warming up dangerously. That action on climate change, especially sacrificial action that hits us in the pocketbook, well, that isn't necessary because there is no proof scientifically that cannot be disputed. So a little doubt. Similarly, at different times in different contexts, we are told that we live in a post-racial society where prejudice and racism have been defeated. We are told that we can have more transit without more taxes. We're told that we can fight wars without having to worry about veterans suffering post-traumatic stress or homelessness because the government has that looked after. We can have bright and academically successful kids no matter how much screen time they spend. And in case none of these issues seem really serious to you personally, don't forget that this week Donald Trump said that the USA needs to restart the nuclear arms race. And he pretty much threatened military action against North Korea should it test another missile. And I haven't even touched on the various other ecological or poverty or human rights issues that dog our society, but which many people just don't want us to see. So again, I wonder, how do we see things? For as Jesus said, if we don't see right, if our eye is not healthy, our bodies, including our body politic, will be full of darkness. How do we see things? It would be nice, of course, if in response to the reality of living in a post-truth society, I could offer up a simple antidote that would fix this problem, or at least would fix 50% of this problem, kind of like our flu shot fixes 50% of the problem. I can't. Still reading our text closely, I was struck by two things that are worth keeping in mind and I think worth hanging on to. Two things that give us at least, well, I think of it as two things that give us a place to stand as we consider what to do. And first, Jesus says, therefore, consider whether the light is in you. Therefore, consider. This is the language of rationality and wisdom. The language of doing the hard intellectual work of making sense of something. Humans are not naturally inclined to do the hard work of thinking rationally. Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman, in a book entitled Thinking Fast and Slow, which he wrote, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, argues, in fact, that our human brains love to make up just-so stories, especially to confirm our personal biases, and that our brain often makes quick, intuitive judgments based on far too little evidence and study, because it's just very easy for our brain to do this. It's how we've evolved. We've evolved to live in a world full of surprising and immediate danger, like tigers and lions that want to eat us. So jumping to conclusions in that ancient world was good, because you didn't have time to think about whether that was a lion or whether it was a great ground sloth. To make matters worse, especially in today's complex world, says Kahneman, the rational, slowly, more lately evolved, deeper informed part of the brain that is supposed to keep odd beliefs and intuitions about things like birtherism or climate change in check, that part of the brain is usually far too slow and lazy to do so. Brains usually handle difficult or mysterious ideas by ignoring their inner complexities, unless we make a point of thinking slowly and rationally, of using therefores and considers. Now, the tobacco industry knew this. Trump, the alt-right, other groups, they know this. But both as individuals and as a community, we have to do better than default to fast, sloppy thinking. We have to consciously make a habit of the hard work of rationality. We are supposed to be, after all, Homo sapiens. That is, translated from the Latin, wise people. And the Bible is actually full of advice that suggests we take this kind of academic headwork very seriously. The Bible does not have a single anti-intellectual verse in it. I could suggest hundreds of passages, but let me just give you three passages that kind of sum up where the Bible is at on this. Hold on to instruction. Do not let it go. Guard it well, for it is your life. That's from Proverbs. Or, preach the word, be prepared in and out of season, correct, rebuke, encourage with great patience, slowly, and with careful instruction, with wisdom and insight. That's from Timothy. And third passage, surely you desire truth in the inner parts. You teach me wisdom in my inmost place. The psalmist speaking of what God does and wants to do for us. So think rationally, slowly. But there's one more thing to keep in mind, I think. It isn't just abstract truth that we're after, is it? Like a mathematical equation that we know to be true. And Jesus knows this too. So Jesus says that, you know, after people light a lamp, they don't put it in the cellar. No, when they light a lamp, they put it in the middle of the room so that it lights everything up. But in this case, Jesus is actually thinking of himself as the light that the eye is supposed to see, that needs to shine for everyone to see. In John 14, for example, Jesus says of himself that, you know, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He is our light. And there is a kind of truth embodied in Jesus' life that we're especially supposed to get. It's the truth of making a life around the needs, wants, hopes, and dreams of your neighbor. Orthopraxis is the Latin word. Jesus' light has to do with right action with respect to your neighbor, rather than right doctrine, orthodoxy. Jesus doesn't care about the mere facts, orthodoxy, as much as he cares about facts' use and how they can be used, or how the facts demand action on behalf of our neighbors. Rather than let mere self-interest be our guide for rank ordering the truth we attend to and care about in the light of Christ, we must see the world through our neighbor's eyes, thereby spicing our truth with empathy and compassion, and thinking long and hard about that. This is seeing truly the truth in love. It's not an easy thing to find in today's world. It's not an easy thing for any of us to offer up. It's not like there's a switch in our back that we can flip and we got it right. This living the truth in love with our neighbor's perspective first in mind is perhaps even more difficult than living rationally. But for the sake of the neighbor, for the sake of the planet, for the sake of our children and their children's children in generations to come, this thinking rationally in love with the perspective of our neighbor first, that is the only thing we dare aim for. At least, that's how I see it. Thank you.